beating around the bush.
Beating around?
Around the bush.
Beating.
Beating.
Beating around the bush.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Beating Around the Bush, the podcast of the Rural Business Collective. We are at episode 10, a time in our lives that we will probably not soon forget. The coronavirus is top of mind for everyone. Last episode, in episode 9, we did talk about stories that weren't coronavirus related to give everyone a little bit of a reprieve, but we feel like this week there's nothing else really we should be talking about. My name's Fleur Anderson. I'm your host this week, and I'm joined by my co-host Wade Dabnett at an appropriate social distancing space down in South Australia. Hello, Wade. How are you?
G'day, Claire. How are you? I mean, I like keeping my distance and I don't really like getting up into people's grill anyway. So it's just part of the course for me.
Yeah. Well, farmers are sort of probably the one people that are probably down with all this social distancing workplaces and going on about things. So there's...
Look, I mean, it's bullshit on my behalf. I mean, I love socialising and... love having a yarn to people, particularly face-to-face, and this is going to be a dark time for me, I think.
Thoughts and prayers for Wade.
Yeah. So what's been happening? How are the Andersons preparing for what lies ahead for social distancing, and how's your doomsday prepping husband that we heard about the other day? Has all his worst fears come to fruition?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. It's been a good social experiment on doomsday prepping, because it turns out that there's some that believe in the theory and some that believe in the action. So Kirk has been quite strict with the other members of the family, but then and everything's been cancelled, everything from, you know, swimming lessons to visiting the neighbours and all those sorts of things. However, when it comes to things like a field day, all of a sudden that becomes an essential service. And having a tinny around the back of the ute with his neighbour, that's okay, because they sit on opposite sides of the ute tray, and that's their social distancing measure. So,
well, I mean, typically a ute tray is 1.5 metres wide.
Yes, that's what he tells me.
Okay.
That's what he tells me. So
you just don't want to lean in too far.
Oh, yeah. I just think it's interesting that we can all have these rules for everyone else, and when it comes to ourselves, it gets a little bit harder to implement. Anyway, that's my dig at my husband on a podcast that he never listens to, so it's probably wasted.
Well, I mean, the barbecues are off, the family dinners are off,
yeah.
the holidays are gone. Mm. So, you know, we are going to have to be really creative on how we fill our time in.
Yeah.
And I would hope that listening to Beating Around the Bush is one of them. So, you know, Kirk should have no excuse now. He's got more time than ever to be able to tune in.
He's also having me in his ear in real life more than ever also. So maybe this is the last thing he'll be going to. This might tip him over the edge.
Yeah.
The kids are home from school. My work has been effectively smashed for the rest of the year. I've had everything cancelled. It's an interesting time. I've gone from travelling around the countryside and to becoming a bit of a homeschool mum, which is something that I always thought was a blessing of living so close to Theodore, is that I didn't have to do distance ed with my kids. But, you know, and my daughter's first year at boarding school hasn't exactly gone to plan, which is a little bit sad for her. But hopefully, you know, hopefully we can get on top of this, and these social distancing measures and things people take seriously, and we can get back on top before tomorrow.
Yeah, it's interesting, all the tweets during the week. I thought, you know, on a positive note, a lot of the station people have been saying, hey, we've been doing remote education and distance education for decades and a century in Australia, so we've got this. We know how to do it.
Yeah.
We know what resources are required. And, yeah, it does sort of highlight the amazing job that, you know, station people go through to educate their kids, that they can't just send them down the driveway, jump on a bus and away they go for the day. They've actually got to do that whole plan themselves. So 100%. Australia are getting a taste of what it's like to live remotely.
Yeah, it's exactly right. Because, I mean, there's a lot of these families that are probably doing exactly the biggest, you know, complaint I've heard from station mums is that they've gone to town to do their big shop and they're only allowed one can of, you know, one can of chickpeas and one bottle of milk, which isn't their normal shop, you know, some things like that, which have been a bit, you know, it's all a bit ridiculous. It's really learning. This is an interesting time to see what it's like running everything on the fly. Really, everything is on the fly.
Well, I think that's a lot of what we'll talk about today is, you know, this is just really unprecedented for everyone, unless you lived through the Depression and probably largely the First World War. Mm-hmm. You know, there hasn't been something of this magnitude that's impacted people domestically here in Australia.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's so many elements of your life that you look at, and it's a big unknown of how this is going to impact us. I mean, it's one thing, you know, that all of a sudden we're told stay at home, no barbecues, you know, send your kids to school, but keep them home if you want. Mm. You know, how this is going to unfold is just a big question mark. And I think that's what's got people worried, and that's what's got people in a panic, because, you know, you think about some of the biggest things that we were complaining about and whinging about as a country was climate change, fueled by the fires. And, you know, probably the second biggest issue was we didn't know whether a man or a woman was a man or a woman.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
Well, and I mean, there's been no shortage of memes and things going around, but the one I thought was interesting is said, you remember that time where, you know, the needles were in the strawberries? Those were the days, weren't they?
Yeah,
you know,
like, that's right.
Yeah, you know, that
that's
was,
right.
This is, yeah, it's bloody crazy.
It is crazy. So probably let's dive into it, Fleur. Yeah. You know, we sort of avoided it last week thinking, where's this all going to land? Let's talk about something other than Corona, because it really had plagued our news feeds for, you know, for probably a good month.
Yeah.
But it's to the point now, I think, I mean, no surprises to a lot of our listeners that, you know, my go-to for general news is The Australian. And, you know, 25 out of the 25 articles on their homepage online, on the online app, were all about coronavirus.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can't really go to a news source and read about something else.
No.
At this point in time. So why the hell wouldn't we talk about it?
And all roads lead there too. Every single industry, every single news item, everything somehow links back to it too. So there's really nothing else going on. So, yeah, so where do we want to start?
Well, I mean, I don't know anything that sort of rivals it. You talk about, people talk about the Spanish flu, where a quarter of the, you know, population, I think it was 500 million people were wiped out or something like that. Is that right? So that was huge. But as I said, domestically in Australia, you know, unless you actually went to war or were part of the Depression, I don't think we've had something that has touched everyone to this extent. So what I've found really interesting is, you know, we sat down on Sunday night and we had the PM addresses, and I think that's when the penny dropped for every Australian that went, okay, I've been in denial, but now this actually genuinely impacts me. They're shutting the pubs. We'd heard about, you know, the UK shutting the pub measures, and, you know, potentially New Zealand were going to full lockdown. When our Prime Minister stands up and tells us that's exactly what we're going to do, I think that was a big penny drop moment. In a business sense, we've probably been dealing with it. You know, what are the sort of policies we need to put in place? What are the governance requirements? But all of a sudden, shit, okay, personally, we're now being locked down.
Yeah.
So what I've found really interesting is the different approach that Donald Trump has had. On this. And I know, you know, again, no surprises that people think I'm going to start by talking about Donald Trump. But I think while the world has gone and has a very risk-averse approach, and I think Australia, maybe not so much as the UK and New Zealand at this point in time, but we feel like we're heading that way.
Mm.
The US and Trump in particular, his approach towards, you know, their economic stimulus and the shutdown of the US is different.
Yeah.
He's making claims that the US is not designed to be shut down. And his big position is that the cure cannot be worse than the issue.
Mm.
And I think there's a number of articles, but there's two that we'll put up the links in the show note. Three from the Australian Financial Review, where, you know, he talks about the US economy has to remain open and it needs to be raring to go by Easter. And he's talking about a shutdown for weeks, not months, which is the exact opposite of what everyone else is saying. I found that very interesting. I'm not sure if you picked that up, Fleur, what your thoughts are on it.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. I mean, you know, he can say statements like that about how, the economic impacts are going to be huge and all these sorts of things. Yes, that is very true. But, you know, when he's saying, the doctors say shut down the entire world and that would be wonderful and we're the number one economy in the world and we can't do that. Are you really the number one economy in the world, Donald? I don't want to talk about that elephant in the room. But the other thing is that I guess he's probably, I can guarantee that their health system isn't prepared for that measure. I can guarantee that that's not true. And I do see what he says about the economy. I think he's making the inference that no other country is caring about their economy, and I don't think that's fair. I think that Scott Morrison in Australia, for example, they've been very concerned about how to balance this fine line between health and economic impact. And, you know, there are some schools of thought that if you just shut things down and go really tight and we've got better chance of shortening this period of time, you know. So, I think he's off his head.
I think he's not. I mean, it's interesting. Like, some of the comments that he's made aren't wholly and solely just about economic impact, but he's saying that anxiety, depression, things like suicide could be a greater killer than this, than the actual virus itself. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to balance, the anxiety because of the economic impact and what's going to happen with social distancing. How does that balance up? So,
speaks to the American social services sector as well, you know, the support that they're going to be receiving there for mental health, small business, employment, things like that is probably not going to be the same measures that we're going to be seeing in Australia for support.
No, that's right. That's one of the biggest things that Bernie Sanders has been talking about. They don't have universal healthcare. The big question is Trump, and some articles are saying this is his, the biggest roll of the dice that he's played in punting the economy over life. Yeah. But you've already seen the Dow respond overnight, significantly from the stimulus package that the US have announced, and that is going to reverberate back through a rebound in the ASX today being Wednesday the 25th. So it's really interesting how every leader is taking this slightly different. I mean, that I also picked up in terms of countries' response to the lockdown. So India has just announced a lockdown of its entire population of 1.3 billion people. You've got Trump on one hand that's saying the US was not designed to be locked down and we're a social economy and that's how we've got to, rule the world.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you've got 1.3 billion people being locked down, where I think to date you've had 800 cases or something like that in India, which no doubt is grossly underestimated at this point in time. And it could be huge, but you sort of think 1.3 billion people with complete lockdown versus the amount of people that have this flu. And yet you think about the death that India would have to deal with in its population the normal flu and a whole raft of other issues.
Yeah.
And yet this is the one that locks 1.3 billion people down. It is just such a confusing time.
It is interesting. I mean, I think it says a lot about the sort of nature of this other country too. I mean, social distancing and some of those measures, the interim measures, you've got your sort of levels and that middle level, which is where Australia's probably been sitting up until today. Those measures wouldn't work in a country like India. That's my personal hunch, is that they sort of didn't have that midpoint. They sort of had to jump to the top end of that.
And then I reckon Australia feels to me like it sort of landed in the middle. We've got the full lockdown where, no more gatherings than two people in the UK and New Zealand's gone down a similar path. We've got, old mate Trumpy that's saying, we're going to beat our way through this by, being an economic powerhouse. And I think you've got Australia in the middle of this. They've been really responsive with an economic stimulus package. We're seeing unprecedented level, going to see unprecedented levels of unemployment that we haven't seen since the Depression. I mean, you know, the estimates are at least 10, maybe up to 15%, which is probably similar to what the US is going to see.
Yeah.
You know, I think someone was saying the US economy is actually going to shrink by an annualised rate of 30% in the second quarter of the year. Mm. So, you know, Australia is probably going to follow suit. So we're sort of sitting in the middle, I think, where we're really balancing that economic sort of response versus how do we lock down, you know, the population. And, you know, we saw the Prime Minister make his announcement on Sunday night, another one last night being Tuesday. You know, so where are we going to go to from here? So it seems they've taken a stepped approach versus, as I said, India, who, you know, probably just went, holy crap, we've got to shut down 1.3 billion people. Let's do it now.
Yeah. I think you're right. I mean, and probably an interesting place to go from here is about Scott Morrison's response. I think these national addresses that we're seeing now, I think, are really good. I think he's doing a really good job of dancing that fine line. I mean, I've thought about what it would be like to be in that room at the moment, and it's, you know, him and teachers, neither of them are paid enough at the moment. I think that it's, you know, like it is a fine line, and you do have to consider both things. So I think a lot of people really seem to, depending on where they're bent or where they sit in that section, have got, you know, health as a priority or economics as a priority or community functioning. He can't sit on any of those things. He's got to be able to dance in between all of those, and it's a really fine line. I actually think this is the redemption post bushfires of ScoMo. I think he's been strong. I think he's been clear in his communication, and I think he's sort of you know, being able to communicate this concept to the broader population that we are all in this together and we're all moving forward together, which I think is something, you know, politically that we really, really need at the moment.
Yeah. I think, I mean, it's interesting when you compare it to the bushfires. I mean, obviously this has followed the bushfires and the drought and the issues that he's faced since, you know, being re-elected and almost coming into office as Prime Minister. Mm. But, you know, we're talking about the apocalypse of coronavirus versus the bleep on the radar of the bushfires. Now, I'm not trying to downplay the bushfires and the impact that's had. It's been absolutely devastating. But, you know, at the time they wanted, you know, people wanted to see people of action, and it was really unclear about what the Prime Minister's role when it's really state-managed. But what we're seeing now with the coronavirus, he has to be the individual at the front leading this country.
Yeah.
So it is appropriate that he's there and he's filling that role perfectly. And I mean, I've been accused perhaps on this of being a bit of a fan of ScoMo, but I am. I mean, I look and I've sent to my wife the last couple of nights, thank God we haven't got Bill Shorten as the Prime Minister.
Absolutely.
I mean, can you imagine him getting up every night and talking to Australians like the kindergarten kids?
Yeah.
Like, give me a break. You know, I think ScoMo has to be all things to all people, and he's doing it, and he's doing it well. I mean, you look at the press conferences and some of the ridiculous questions that are asked of him. And if we go back to the bushfires,
Andrew,
he was accused of not being, you know, compassionate, which is absolute bullcrap.
Yeah.
Because if you actually go back through ScoMo's whole life, his political life, he is a man of compassion. There's no doubt about it. He's a religious man.
Mm.
And, you know, then he's getting asked stupid questions when he's talking about complete lockdown and one of the worst episodes ever to happen to the Australian economy since the Depression. And then a reporter asked him, you know, do you care about the people and are you sorry that people have lost their jobs? I mean, how insulting is that
Absolutely.
To someone that supposedly put together a $189 billion stimulus package together, and the one question he can get asked by a bloody stupid left-wing journalist is, does he care and is he sorry?
Yeah.
I mean, give me a break. And, you know, but he took that and answered it perfectly, and I think, you know, he's showing to be, you know, quite calm and quite precise. But of course, you know, the haters be hating. You know, they say, oh, mixed messages and all this sort of stuff. Well, you know, there's no playbook here.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there's no rules that he's following, and we'll only be able to judge them on the performance, you know, well down the track on this one.
Well, that's what they say, cometh the man, cometh the hour, or cometh the hour, cometh the man. And I think he has stepped up. I have to say, as a side note, watching those press conferences, it's become a little bit of a game for me to wait for, you know, him to smack down Andrew, you know, the
Andrew Proben, the ABC political reporter.
Enough from you, Andrew. I think that's been the highlight of my night watching those press conferences. I think, I completely agree with you. This is something that we do strongly agree on together. I think he's cracking it. You know, I started to think about the stuff that he did get through the bushfires, and I reckon a lot of it is actually just about personal presentation skills. People aren't actually judging him on what he's doing and what he's saying. They're doing things like, you know, he has that funny resting smirk face, you know? And you can see his lip almost quivering trying to fight that in these press conferences because he knows that that's what he's getting judged on. By the way, his mouth rests while people are asking questions instead of actually what's coming out of his mouth.
At least he's got a natural face. I mean, half the bloody people you see on TV these days in all these reality TV shows, they can't move their face. Have you seen Married at First Sight? My God.
Yes, so, this is true. So, you know, a bit of Botox and fix it, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, I hope not, because, I mean, he's not elected as a parliamentarian, and he's not elected as prime minister because of his looks. And I think that's the key point, isn't it? Yep. I mean, if you're trying to how down someone because they have a resting smirk face, I mean, I think that highlights the lack of depth that we had in terms of criticism. Now the question is, you know, to judge him on his performance, but don't do it now because now's the time that we need him to lead, and you don't want to put question marks on whether he's up to the grade, because he's the leader that we've got.
Yep.
We'll deal with that down the line.
And it's sort of divided up, split up a lot of this identity politics too, which I think has been nice. All the things we've talked about in the past have been about affecting one particular group, or what are we doing about, even with drought, you know, it's about the farmers, or it's about the bushfires, or about the, you know, the climate change and all that. It's all very about certain sections of the community, or pitting people against each other. Whereas this all in it together thing has really probably been something that Australia I'm not saying we needed this. This isn't the, you know, the virus that Australia needed, that's for sure. But this is something that's been a nice thing to observe, how we respond as a country when something affects us all as individuals.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a good lead into where it's going to go from here. I mean, as I said, we saw a lot of social issues, you know, plague the agenda for the last couple of years. You know, the economy is probably about the last thing. You're almost sort of a real, you know, real rank sort of socialist build that we saw with some of the hard left policies as well, and the sort of, you know, why are the Libs so obsessed with having a strong economy, and, you know, that's like boring. Let's talk about, you know, as I said, whether or not, you know, a man should be called a man and a woman should be called a woman, and let's focus on climate change. But now, you know, we don't see any of it. So where's it going to respond from here? We heard in 2014 from Tony Abbott the age of entitlement was over. Mm-hmm. Well, that's sort of, I don't think, quite eventuated, but surely it is now.
Yeah.
That was something that you picked up in your articles for?
Yeah, I did. I actually got forwarded an article from a listener. Jordan, he passed this on, and he said he was interested about what our thoughts were on this, and it was about the end of the road for the lollipop economy, and about what this is signalling for the Aussie economy. And there's a lot of articles that have spoken to this same thing about how is this going to shape and change the way we view our economy going forward. And I think the article is really spot on. Obviously, there'll be a link to it in the show notes along with the others that we've mentioned. But it talks about, like, you know, it's sort of opening up by saying we're living in a country where a person holding a stop-go sign on the road is being paid $180,000 a year, which is more than double our teachers, and how out of step that is. And that was
ridiculous.
Absolutely ridiculous. And what that sort of says and signals about our economy, you know, or basically our banana republic, really. And and, you know, I think this is a really good time to focus on what a genuine, strong economy looks like. And it's not just economic growth in terms of just numbers and our export and our GDP just increasing at any cost. This is actually about our business sustainability and our ability to bounce back as an economy. And I think it's this is definitely the time where this is coming to the fore, and we might start seeing a little bit of a realignment on that. And I think for the you know, for ScoMo and those, you know, it's not an election year, obviously, but I think this will last for a long time about the impacts of our economic strength on everyday Australians.
Yeah, I think it is going to be really interesting to see what we rebound. I think the country is going to go through a massive shift in its values. I think it has to. We've actually seen, you know, the likes of Trump and Boris Johnson get elected on really nationalist agendas. Maybe we're going to see that in Australia start to rise as a result of this. I mean, we know that we are very fortunate in the fact that we have wonderful food security. You know, the numbers out there suggest that we can feed and support 75 million people with what we produce here. But there's a lot of things in which we don't, and have seen, you know, the degradation of the manufacturing and processing industries and some of those things. And is that where we're going to maybe move towards? If you talk about, you know, the long-term sustainability of the economy, is it being able to ride out these storms better than what we have been now? And, you know, again, we're only going to be able to work through that after the fact. But it's amazing, isn't it, when you think about it now, what are the roles that we really value and really cherish in the economy? And I don't think someone getting paid 180 grand to hold a lollipop is appropriate. And this is where I think the unions have got a lot to answer for, where, you know, those successful unions that have been the strongest and their ability to lobby on behalf of their members has mean, I think, we've got some people within the economy that are paid out of step with what the rest of the country views and values them to be. And as nurses and teachers, my God, they're absolute gold today, aren't they? Because without them, the country has gone to a halt.
Well, and it's not only out of step of what we think's reasonable, it's out of step to the contribution they're making. You know, like a generally, you know, you're paid for the contribution that you make in the role that you play in, you know, what cog in the wheel are you? And you get paid according to that. And that is definitely not what's been happening. And actually in that article from the Fin Review, it said it's the almost guaranteed recession the country is about to suffer will make a few other things crystal clear. It will reveal what everyone has always known about our industrial relations system, and namely that its primary purpose is to increase wages and conditions of those in work. It literally literally led to us having the world's highest minimum wage, and that does nothing to encourage employment. So,
but I couldn't believe the unions coming out this week suggesting that we need to see a rise in the minimum wage by 4%. You know, I mean, are they drunk?
Yeah,
like, it's more about the 15%. You know, we're going to go from 5% to 15%. You know, potentially with our unemployment rate.
Yeah.
Shouldn't they be more focused on how we're going to get those people back into work and what is a sustainable business going to be? Because life as we know it will change. The hospitality sector is going to change. Like, I've got a lot of friends, and like we all do, that work in the hospitality sector, and they are now, you know, possibly going to be some of the poorest people in this country. You know, are people just going to go and, you know, set up a coffee shop around the corner off the bones of their ass and live paycheck by paycheck because they love the idea of working for themselves, you know?
Yeah. It has challenged a lot of people. It's challenged a lot of those ideals that we hold as Australians about being small business owners and about those sorts of things. And I think the thing is, like, you know, on one side you've got someone vote, you know, advocating for a 4% rise in the minimum wage. That the flip, everything's got a flip side. Everything's got an equal and opposite reaction. And so the flip side of that is what? That then then employers can't afford to employ at that rate, so they scale down their workforces, go towards more automation or whatever, or don't expand their businesses. So then the flip side of that is what? That then we have to bolster welfare as to account for the increase of unemployment, you know? So everything's got an equal and opposite reaction, and I just think it's got to lead to some sort of indicator beyond just.
And this is, I mean, in terms
pocket.
Of welfare, this is the key, isn't it? We've heard for a long time people saying we need to raise the level of Newstart. Well, you know, the government has come out and rolled out significant welfare stimulus packages and support, and that is totally appropriate. We are now spending way over the amount of income tax that we collect in this country, so that's going to have to be scaled back.
Yeah.
So the only way that we can take people off welfare is to put them into work. The only way you can put them into work is to ensure businesses have the right sort of framework in place to start up again, and that includes small business. Now, you know, we can't have penalty rates that make it impossible for a coffee shop to open up on a Sunday when that's when everyone wants to go out and have their bloody coffee. Like, it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the same as the penalty rates that we see in farming. We get some exemptions to go feed some sheep, but I can't get an exemption to go harvest potatoes.
Yeah.
And yet we require, you know, 24/7 supply to the population today. So I think the power's going to come back to the employer, and it bloody well has to, because I don't know where a lot of these people are going to get their jobs.
Yeah, that's right.
If you've been in business thinking about automation, I mean, this is something you're going to seriously look at, isn't it?
Yeah,
you know, I 100%. Think we're going to see and stimulation in the economy by people investing in technology, not necessarily people.
Oh, and not to mention continued offshore manufacturing and in importing and those sorts of things as well, that all get driven by two things, labour prices and energy prices. So, yeah. You know.
The unions need to be thinking a little bit more than the minimum wage.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this has been a fun union bashing pro-liberal episode.
It really has, hasn't it? It really has. This is all moving really quickly, and one thing that is continually moving that we've talked about, whether we mention it here on the podcast or not, and that has been some of the stimulus packages that have been coming out and what some things are available to people. In my mind, I feel like we probably couldn't even do that justice at the moment, and that might be something we can talk about even in a bonus episode or something when we've got a bit of a clearer picture around, you know, because the tranches are still rolling through with that. But there has been significant stimulus. You've got a nice little link there that will from Smart Company that we can put in the show notes for people to sort of see where we're at.
Yeah, easy to follow the links, because I think they've obviously, like everyone, they've got a series of announcements as the stimulus has been rolled out. So I think jump on there, have a look. And if anyone's got any specific questions they want to ask about it or want us to explore, I think we need to probably get some people far smarter than you and I, no offence, to dive into some of those things.
100%. No, that's good. Look, probably the final point I'd, you know, things to talk about today is we've talked a lot about the economic impacts, but I think bringing it back to our audience is the agricultural impacts. I think probably two things. One is that we probably haven't seen what this will do in agriculture yet. It's not an immediate impact, what that will do with markets and supply chains and things like that going forward. Who knows what the future might hold there, and a lot of things have got to roll before that comes through. But I have really enjoyed seeing people come forward talking about our position with food security and highlighting that as a positive for agriculture in Australia. I think that's been done really well, and it's something that's been really positive to see, particularly on Twitter there. I know you've seen it, the video, one that stands out, Sam Hegney. He did a great video. I really enjoyed that.
And that's what it needs to be, ag telling its story, simple message coming from the source about exactly what we can achieve and what we do achieve for the Australian economy. And I think, you know, here's the thing. We can sort of, you know, talk around circles and talk to ourselves a lot about the story that we should be telling, and you know, but the proof's in the pudding. Yep. When the world shits the bed, agriculture's there to support it, and that's what's happening again and
put
again.
Put that on a bumper sticker. Yeah.
You know, agriculture is the industry that when all the indexes, when all the other industries potentially collapse, people still need to eat. And I think that just highlights Australia, you know, the wonderful position that Australia is in with the level of food security that we have. And we've got to celebrate that, and we've got to continue to celebrate it. And that's why, you know, the NFF telling your story piece, yep, that was great, and I think we need to see it continue. But what Sam's video shows is that we do it pretty well at a grassroots level.
Yep. So those that haven't seen that, you know, the link will be there. But basically Sam's sitting in his tractor doing a bit of a tractor video talking about the crops he's planting and what that will actually translate into. So, you know, an example, he talked about his two paddocks of barley that he's planting will translate into two tinnies for every Australian, and you know, and the millions of cans of chickpeas from this paddock. And so that was, you know, it's relatable. And I think that's something that, you know, all of this stuff we've been talking about, telling our story over the last, you know, at least 12 months, it's been a real hot topic, that when it's relevant, people will listen. And it's relevant right now, and people want to, they want to hear that message because they understand how it directly affects them. So, you know, so I guess that's one silver lining out of all of this madness.
Well, that's a good positive note to lead us into the last bit, Fleur, that you've jumped on and sorted out over the course of the week.
Yeah, I think a couple of episodes ago we talked about, we just mentioned briefly after the Four Daughters beef, the story of the four Penfold girls and their mum and dad out at Meandara in Queensland. They were on Landline talking about their beef exporting into China. And at the tail end of that story, they mentioned that they had $600,000 worth of beef stuck on a ship in meant to be going because their contracts were into Wuhan. So I just thought it would be timely to just touch base with them, see how they're going, see what their position is now, and what they're what they've learnt from that about you know, their security of their supply chain and their food chain and what they're going to go forward. So we'll leave this episode with a quick chat with Bonnie Penfold, one of the daughters from Four Daughters Beef, and hearing a little bit about the impacts on them and what they're doing going forward.
No, that's excellent. So I look forward to listening.
Yeah, excellent. Well, been good chatting with you. Stay safe and well down there.
Yep. No, you and your doomsday prepper, Kirk, you just be well up there, and we'll talk through the week and see what's going to unfold.
Yeah, sounds good, mate. All right. Thanks heaps. Right. Talk soon.
See you, mate.
I've taken the opportunity to catch up with Bonnie Penfold. Bonnie is one of the four daughters of Four Daughters Beef, based in Meandara in Queensland. You may have seen their story on Landline recently, talking about how a chance encounter at Beef Week led them down the path of exporting beef into China and into specifically Wuhan under their Four Daughters beef brand. So I thought it'd be a great opportunity to touch base with them and see how things are going now and what this coronavirus might mean for the future of their business as we're all sitting around considering what the impacts are for us. Bonnie, thanks heaps for joining me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, Bonnie, what an interesting time. Why don't we kick off by you telling us a little bit about, I've mentioned that you're with Four Daughters Beef in Meandara. Can you tell us a little bit about the makeup of that business and what sort of markets you play with?
Yeah, I'd love to. So we live near Meandara, so about 70 kilometres southwest of Meandara. We have two family properties here that we all work on, so Dad and Mum, myself, Molly, Jemima and Matilda. Jemima's currently away having a year up north, so it's a man down at the moment, but we're still getting along fine. And Matilda's at boarding school in Brisbane. She's currently home at the moment due to the whole virus pandemic thing going on, so it's good to have her home. But at home we just have two places here near Meandara and two feedlots that we run. We have always fed for one of the supermarket chains in Australia, so we have a fairly consistent flow going out to them. So each fortnight we send out 225 head roughly to them, which works out really well, and that's always been what we've done. But then, yes, like you said, so the chance encounter with Frank and Nisha, our colleagues in Wuhan at Beef Week, led us to looking at different opportunities and internationally exporting meat to China. So it's been good. Just a different options, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean, that was a great way to diversify your business, I suppose, because everyone tells us eggs in one basket and those sorts of things, and trying to chase different opportunities.
Exactly, right.
At the time when the Landline piece aired, you actually had some beef held up on its way to Wuhan. Can you tell us a little bit about that, how that situation occurred and how it's resolved itself?
Yeah, so we had a container load of beef already in China once the whole coronavirus pandemic sort of broke out, and that meat was waiting to go through customs. So once the pandemic broke out, it was a bit crazy there for a while, and the meat was sitting obviously in its frozen container, but still plugged in and sitting in the customs. While that one was sitting there, we had another one actually on the boat on the way over. So once it got there, that it also was held up on the wharf. So we had to pay additional fees just to have it held on the wharf, but it didn't take too long after that. So sort of after the landline episode aired, it wasn't too long before those two containers shipments were cleared through customs. But once they were cleared through customs, I guess sort of found another bit of a hiccup. Not so much our problem with the relationship we have with Frank and Nisha. It was more something for them to have to deal with, but getting it from Shanghai to Wuhan was a bit of a challenge, just seeing that so many people over there weren't working and the trucks weren't running. So that was just an additional challenge for the meat to get to Wuhan. But now those two loads are in Wuhan and have been begun to be eaten, I guess. So that's good that it's getting there.
Yeah.
But yeah, looking forward, I guess we're just looking for a few different opportunities as well with the whole pandemic going on. So yeah, it's been going pretty well.
So are you currently continue sending stuff out, or after those two containers went through, did you sort of hit pause on your regular supply there? How's that affected what you're doing today?
Yeah, we haven't hit pause entirely. So they were our loads 6 and 7. Mm-hmm. No, yeah, 5 and 6, sorry. They were our loads 5 and 6. We've currently, just last week, we trucked load 7 down to be killed. And they are still happy to take load 7, which is good because we'd had them fed, obviously. We've also got another 4 months' worth of cattle on feed for them already because they have to be fed for 100 days. So obviously you need to be feeding them in advance. So we've got – so they've – happy to take 7, which they're now should be going on the boat mid this week. And then not sure if they can fully take loads 8 and 9, but they want 10 and 11. So there's just some of the things that we're having to roll with. Like, so with the loads 8 and 9, we're just looking at different options. So I think they're still happy to take some of the bodies, just not all of them. So we're looking at different things and ways to, I guess, further diversify our business domestically. We were thinking of doing some mixed beef packs. So we've been talking with our processor to see if they are able to create mixed beef packs for us to sell domestically along with our rump. So I guess it's just a matter of diversifying and looking for different options at the moment. So the whole diamonds are made under pressure. We're a bit of pressure at the moment, but that's all right. We're just looking for different options to come up with small plants.
Yeah, that's good. It sounds like you're sort of tackling that challenge pragmatically and systematically and going head on. So you mentioned the beef packs along with the rump. So you also have a market. So there's the supermarket chains, but then you also do a little bit of direct-to-consumer domestically with your rumps. Is that right?
Yeah. So the Chinese, when we first made the deal with them, the whole idea was that it was to be full set because – well, originally they said, oh, we want this cut and that cut, and we had to educate them into an understanding that a cow isn't just all cubes, or it isn't all rib fillet. It's got all these different pieces. So you can't just have all the rib fillets because there's a lot more to a cow than that. So once we educated them to that, we sort of had we had an agreement that it would be full set, mm-hmm. which they were fine with, and we did the first few loads were just full set, and they then decided that they didn't want the rumps, which actually works out fine for Australia, really, because so we got the news about the not wanting the rumps, and we were sitting at the dinner table and we were like, that's all right, I think we can get rid of the rumps in Australia. That was Molly's and my idea, and I was like, okay, if you think you can. So we started up our Facebook page, which has been very successful, and we've had a lot of support through. So then we began selling our rumps domestically. So each month, The full set less the rump is put into the shipping container to be sent to Wuhan, and the rumps are sent up to Brisbane, where we go and collect them in a cold truck and then deliver them to people who've ordered them.
Yeah, great. Okay, so you might be able to expand that offering for a little while and use that as a place, a home for the stuff that Wuhan isn't necessarily able to take at that moment. So
yeah, exactly. That's what we're hoping.
And so do you think, going forward, is it still going to be the mix of those three options, supermarket, direct to consumer, and the stuff exported into Wuhan specifically. Is those going to be, you think, your three still solid options, just changing the volume between those three, or are you sort of looking at other export destinations as well?
Well, I think at the moment we're sticking with those three. Like, it's good, it's important to have that diversity, I suppose. So going ahead, I guess, if Wuhan is in lockdown for a little bit longer or other options need to be considered, I guess we'll have to move on to that then. But we're trying not to make too many rush decisions at this time, just because everyone else, it just seems like it's a bit of a panic situation. So I think it's important not to get too caught up in that, but to just take your time to consider our options. So at the moment, we're just sticking with our three markets and just changing the amounts getting sent to each location.
And whereabouts do you get your, advice? It's interesting, we start off as beef producers or whatever, grain producers or whatever, and we're really experts in that space. But then as the, business evolves and supply chains, we get thrown into positions of dealing with things that were not necessarily our first interest. So things like making these decisions around biosecurity or planning ahead for this sort of stuff, have you had resources you've been able to tap into, or where do you get some advice to help you make these decisions?
Well, we started off with just Mum doing a bit of research. She's a primary school teacher, so she's very good at researching and looking at different options, and she's quite good at writing stuff. So she persisted for a while on her own, but then we were invited to join the Shell QGC's Emerging Exporters Program through Tisby and in Toowoomba. Mm-hmm. So they were very helpful in giving us contacts and linking us up with the people that we needed to talk to go forward in our exporting journey, I suppose. They were just very helpful in putting us in the right direction, helping keep track of meat and money and all that sort of stuff. So it's been really great to have them helping us.
Yeah, that's great. And in terms of risk management, have you identified, or how do you deal with, unforeseen risks going forward? So, for example, if your abattoir that you're working with currently shuts down, are they things that you sort of, throw out some crazy risks and work that through as well as a business, or are you really trying to just respond as things occur and not think too much about forecasting risk?
I think at the moment it's kind of just going with what's happening at the time. It's just so uncertain at the moment as to what's happening. And like you said, with the meatworks, there is quite a high possibility that they may have to stop working due to the virus. But at the moment, we're just rolling with what we've got. So it's quite difficult to get custom kills at different meatworks. Mm. So what we've got at Casino actually is very important for us to keep at the moment. So we're just hoping that we can keep going with that, and I guess once, if that does change, well, we'll have to come up with a different plan then, but otherwise sticking with what we've got so far.
Yeah, cool. So just working with it as it rolls along and trying not to get too caught up. It's a hard one when things are moving so rapidly, I guess, to stay on top of it. Really, thanks, Bonnie. It's been really interesting to talk to you about a really good practical everyday example about how people are moving through these things and working and responding to constant change. So, absolutely. Really appreciate your time and all the best, and look forward to seeing the journey of Four Daughters Beef into the future.
Excellent. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Beating Around the Bush, the podcast of the Rural Business Collective. We really hope you're enjoying it.
And if you are, we'd love to hear from you. And probably if you don't too, but we're assuming if you do, you've lasted this long.
Jump on and join the Facebook group, Beating Around the Bush. The link will be in the show notes, where we can keep the conversation flowing. And if you can tell us maybe some of the yarns that you're reading about this week.
Alternatively, you can send us an email to podcasts@ruralbusinesscollective.com.au. And of course, it wouldn't be an outro without doing the whole like, share and subscribe thing.
Yeah, so if you can subscribe within your podcast app and give it a review, that'd be really great, and we'd love it if you could do it.
and share it with a friend. We steal people's phones and subscribe them. We don't condone that, but of course, hey, it's an option.